previously.tv podcast network.
God, this is frightening.
No, man, this is cool. This has got to be the most incredible sight I've ever seen.
Okay, let's not get too carried away.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 184 for the week of December 25th. That's Christmas, 2017. I am giant screwhead warrior thing David T. Cole, and I'm here with sexy yet earnest doctor Sarah D. Bunting.
Stat.
And saxophone sensation Tara Ariano.
I'm going to entertain you on a cable car. Welcome to another special episode of Extra Hot Great. By special, of course, we mean pre-taped. Happy holidays to everyone who is celebrating them.
Like, oh.
Oh my God, Dave. Oh God. Well, if you're still here, thank you for staying. This time, what we thought we would do is, as you know, we... sometimes consider user-submitted canons, and we love that you send them and appreciate them always, but sometimes there are a few that end up orphaned because they're for shows that we don't watch and that our guests don't watch. And so what we thought we would do today is do a bunch of these kind of no-context canons, except we're actually doing one fewer than we thought we would. So shout out Rodney. Is that right?
That's right.
Of New Jersey. Hey, Rodney. We were going
to do his zip or his home address or anything else we could identify him by. Outline of his house key.
I think that's fairly broad. Anyway,
headline: Rodney dead in extra hot great cannon massacre.
Look, we ask people to include their social
killer
security
says,
numbers
got all
with
the
their
information
submissions.
I needed I from podcast host.
Anyway, Rodney C.
R.I.P.
of new something.
New J.
we watched Misfits, the episode that you had asked us to consider for the canon, but then when we went to find your actual submission, we were not able to. And when I say we, I mean Dave. So if you still have it kicking around, please send it again, because we all watched the episode and we would love to discuss it. But for now, we are talking about three entirely different episodes, two standard submitted by you, our users, and one that's very special. based that jumps out from a random item in game time from two regular episodes ago. So hang on for that. But in the meantime, before we get started, thank you to everyone who submits user canons. And if you have any that are burning a hole in your hard drive, please send them on, because after this, the cupboard is pretty much bare, other than
no
what nags, I have
too.
Written.
Don't forget
yeah, no
to
nags
send
too
no
for
nags.
Sure. Yes, we do not have any no nags today, just canons. But let us, if we may, shall we begin, sir and madam?
Indeed.
Certainly.
Okay.
Our first canon is Supernatural, and it's from one of our favorite submitters. Here we go.
Hi, Extra Hot Great. It's Caroline from France. I decided to take the plunge and to submit an episode from my favorite American TV series, Supernatural. This is a TV podcast, so I picked an episode which is all about TV. Episode 8 from Season 5 called Changing Channels. It's well known that Season 5 is by far the best season of the series. In fact, it's possible to create a top 10 list of SPN episodes just with this particular season. It's the season of the apocalypse, culminating with a confrontation between Archangels Michael and Lucifer, and Sam and Dean trying their best to fight for humanity's survival. This episode is part of the long tradition of meta episodes on Supernatural, but it isn't so much fan service here, it's more a general comment on American television. Moreover, it also moves the central plot forward, so it plays an important part in the season's arc. Finally, I think it's quite funny, and it encapsulates what television was about when it aired in 2009. We're starting with a classic, very colorful sitcom decor, with the actors on stage facing an audience, and Dean even has a signature line. So as far as cold open goes, it's fairly atypical of SPN episodes, I'll grant you that. However, it is worth it for the great 80s sitcom-y theme song, accompanied by forced and awkward vignettes that reminds us of Full House or Family Matters. The episode really starts with Dean sitting in his motel room, which uses the same wallpaper as the one in the cold open, but this time with muted colors. Dean is riveted by a scene from his secret favorite show, Dr. Sexy MD, which is actually a parody of Grey's Anatomy. Grey's was at the time in direct competition with SPN on Thursday nights, which is one of the reasons why it's parodied here. Then we see the boys investigating, as usual, a mysterious and violent death. In this particular case, though, the witness swears that the killer was the Incredible Hulk. It doesn't take long for the boys to realize that one of their old foes, the trickster, is behind it all. Before they know it, the boys are stuck in a weird TV land dimension created by the trickster in order to torture them. They have to go along in order to survive. And yes, this plot resembles the plot of the film Stay Tuned, but I don't care if it's derivative because it works. So in the first clip, we can hear the boys who have been thrown into Dr. Sexy MD.
How can this possibly be real? I don't know, all right?
Doctors?
But there goes Dr. Wang, the sexy but arrogant heart surgeon. And there's Johnny Drake. Well, he's not even alive. He's a ghost in the mind of her, the sexy but neurotic doctor over there.
So, this show has ghosts? Why?
I don't know. It is compelling.
I thought you said you weren't a fan.
I'm not. I'm not. Oh, boy.
What?
It's him.
Who?
It's him. It's Dr. Sexy.
Doctor?
Doctor.
Doctor. Doctor.
You want to give me one good reason why he defied my direct order to do the experimental face transplant on Mrs. Beale?
One reason?
Hmm.
Sure.
You're not Dr. Sexy.
You're crazy.
Really? Because I swore part of what makes Dr. Sexy sexy is the fact that he wears cowboy boots, not tennis shoes.
Yeah, you're not a fan.
It's a guilty pleasure.
In this segment, the jokes that work best, in my opinion, are Dean's fangirling all over the place. I especially like his face when he spots Dr. Sexy in the hall. And a comment on Danny Duquette's weird ghost storyline on Grey's Anatomy. It's on point since it was really stupid, and Danny was played by Jeffrey Dean Morgan, aka Papa John Winchester, on Supernatural. The Japanese game show is fun, and I mean, who doesn't love to see guys getting punched in the balls, right? Plus, you know they actually have crazy stuff like that in Japan. But this moment makes us realize that the whole point is to be particularly vicious to Sam. But then he started the apocalypse, so it's only fair. Hence the subsequent commercial where Sam has to admit that he has genital herpes. Back on a sitcom set, Castiel manages to show up for a second time to warn the boys that there might be more than meets the eye here. The exchange between the trickster and Cass makes us realize that there's a history between them. Which leads us to the CSI spoof. And sorry, Sarah, I gotta agree with Dean on procedural cop shows mediocrity, as we can hear in clip number 2.
Oh, come on.
So, what do you think?
What do I think? I think go screw yourself, that's what I think.
Can you give us a sec, please? Thanks. You gotta calm down.
Calm down? I'm wearing sunglasses at night. You know who does that? No town with douchebags. I hate this game. I hate that we're in a procedural cop show. And you want to know why? Because I hate procedural cop shows. It's like 300 on television. They're all the freaking same. It's, ooh, plane crashed here. Oh, shut up.
Hey, what?
Check out Sweet Tooth over there. Think that's him? Just follow my lead.
I think they do a good job mocking David Caruso, the sunglasses, the lousy puns, the delivery, especially Jared Padalecki. It seems like the boys have outwitted the trickster and life should go back to normal. But that's only a fake out. In reality, they are still stuck in TV land and Sam has been turned into Kit from Knight Rider, which is a great way to incorporate the boys' beloved Impala and a great joke in itself. Again here, I thought of Sarah. Finally, we arrive at the final confrontation between the boys and the trickster, who reveals himself to be in reality the Archangel Gabriel. Granted, the actor who plays Gabriel isn't very subtle in this scene, but then again, he's playing a larger-than-life character. And moreover, as I said, this final act does push forward the plot of the season. It seems quite obvious at the end that the odds are against Team Free Will, as Dean puts it. So to me, this episode is canon-worthy. It's typical of the series to make at least one meta episode per season. And although that's special in its own right, the writers make sure to integrate them well within the season's bigger storyline. Moreover, I think it's a good representation of American television at one point in time, and it delivers quite a few laughs. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for the presentation, as always. I love procedurals, but I hate CSI Miami, and this episode shat all over it in the most delightful style. The fake Who scream was the best until Metallicit, and then that was the best. I mean, this show, here's what I always have liked about this show, which I'm not a regular watcher of, but I know people who really like it. My husband has been becalmed by marathons of it before. it doesn't really try, like, despite the fact that they're talking about like archangels and the apocalypse and whatnot, like it's still not trying to do too much usually. And you know, the leads are cute. This was funny. I thought the send-ups were good. It was an amusing way to spend 41 minutes. I don't know. I really liked it. Maybe it was like a little pleased with itself at times, but I thought legitimately. And I also thought that, you know, the shows that I didn't watch that it was parodying, like I still got it. So I thought it was good.
It might've seemed pleased with itself, but you have to like put it on a scale. Like you put Supernatural pleased with itself up against something like Community pleased with itself.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it really kind of puts things in perspective, I think.
Yeah. Right.
And I
think that's the line that you're trying to stay on the right side of. And I think they did.
Agreed.
Yes. And I mean, she says in her submission, like they do one of these a season, like, okay, one in 22 is fine. All in 22 is too much, which is, that was the
point. What if it was all star wipes?
Right. That's the Community downfall. Should I go next?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. I also was very charmed by this. I think this is the first episode of Supernatural I've ever seen.
Really?
And knowing that it was, at the time scheduled directly opposite Grey's Anatomy makes that spoof all the more amusing to me, because that also means they would have been scheduled opposite CSI at the time then too. Cause that was their another, time slot competitor that they would have had.
That's
then.
Right.
This was really cute. I could see how if you and the fact that it comes five seasons in, I think also detracts from the pleased with itself fitness. I mean, I have no way of knowing what other meta episodes they would have done prior to this or, you know, what format they would have taken. But the fact that they waited this long to do something like this specifically is like that shows restraint. And I respect that. And I can imagine how tickled you would be if you were a regular viewer of the show when this one came along. Like, it's cute. They and the attention to detail that they put into all of the parodies, including the commercial, is really admirable and key. Like, you can't half-ass something like this. You have to really commit to making it look like the thing you're trying to do. And I think they do a good job with that. The Who screen that Sarah mentioned is an example of that. And the fact that the lead doctor on Dr. Sexy MD is Dr. Ellen Piccolo, which is sure close to Dr. Ellen Pompeo, was also amusing to me. Yeah, it was good. I think Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki are limited as actors, but I think based on this, the show does a good job of pitching in their strike zone. Is that a correct way to use that phrase? I liked it. This is the kind of thing that made me, I don't know if I'd necessarily go out of my way to watch it, but if adding this to my list of acceptable hotel room TV shows is no small feat. So thank you for letting us watch it. Dave.
The leads, I mean, you know, they may not be major, you know, Stratford thespians, but there is something I think that they do better, which is like, they're the pretty boy leads, right?
Yeah.
But they're genuinely having fun here.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, you can tell they are having fun on the set and with each other. And there's a lot of times with a lot of just pretty faces on TV, and let's just like throw almost every procedural on CBS into this, you know, under the bus here, like where they are really just pretty faces. And I can't, like, in my mind, they're all just like fuzzy. I have face blindness, right? I can't remember the actor. These two guys I remember after, right? You know, because they're generally having a good time with it. And especially in this episode, it pays dividends because, you know, the whole thing is kind of a goofy spoof, especially when they get into like the herpes commercial where, you know, he has to play along, but he really doesn't want to. It's really good. There was a clip from King of the Mountain when we were doing that. I don't know if it was an outtake or a credit sequence, but one of them is singing Eye of the Tiger or one of those Rocky. They're the best around, like one of those 80, you know, cool guy anthems. And it's joyful in the same way. And I thought this was like just pretty funny. Like that they got the sitcom thing out of the way first was smart because that is like the most worn of everything they did.
Yeah.
Right. Like that is always the go-to, the freeze frame credit joke, the, you know, walking into applause joke, the catchphrase joke. Like that's stuff everybody's done. So it was nice that you get that out of the way, you know, so you know what's going on, that, you know, here they are trapped in TV land, and then move on to, you know, Miami, CSI Miami, Knight Rider, which I thought, oh, there you go. There's the Sarah hook. So
I'd also say, sorry, just to jump in about the sitcoms and the credits thing. This is also from 2009. So this was before everyone who had Final Cut on their computer was doing like, it's Game of Thrones, but as a TGIF show credits, like on YouTube. This was probably before the vast majority of those. So I'll give them credit for that too.
Yeah. It was kind of funny to see the same font here. And is that the Full House font they were using? Is that what that was from? Okay. Cause I was like, oh, it's the Too Many Cooks font, having never seen Full House in my life. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. I thought everybody on the show was having fun. And I didn't understand what the hell was going on with the apocalypse. I know, like, you know, they triggered it and everybody's mad at them, but that was enough. That's all I needed to know to enjoy this episode. And enjoy it, I did.
Yeah. Same.
Yeah.
All right. So let's put this to a vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
It's a yes for me, or a we.
And Tara Ariano.
Yeah, for me too. This is a show that knows what it is, and I respect that. So
I agree.
Fun.
And it was generally fun. Exactly. That means Supernatural Season 5, Episode 8, Changing Channels. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon. Forgot to play the theme music on the first one. all right, so here comes the second one.
I wondered about that.
Well, let's just get into it, shall we?
Sure.
Hello, Extra Hot Great. This is Matthew Siegel from Tampa, Florida.
And I just want to say, Matthew submitted two canon entries in the past. This is his third. And in his email, he said, this is my third canon entry, so I'm going to swing for the fences. So keep that in mind.
Okay.
Here we go.
My canon submission this time is the 8th episode of the anime series Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann, titled Later Buddy. Tengen Toppa Gurren Lagann, also known as Gurren Lagann or TTGL, was a 2007 anime explicitly designed to function as both a loving send-up and ultimate celebration of the excesses and joys of Saturday morning cartoons in general and the giant mecha genre in particular. The internet quickly latched onto the show for the way it, in its own words, went beyond the impossible in terms of bombast and spectacle. But underneath the memes, TTGL was a supremely well-structured and considered show, one which never rejected nuance, even if it was often the opposite of subtle, qualities which are exemplified in this episode. In the previous 7 episodes, we had watched as our two main characters, the brash and charismatic Kamina, along with his stalwart and introverted brother Simon, made a series of great revolutionary strides, first breaking out of their underground prisons, then taking the fight to their oppressors, the ruthless beastmen and their giant mecha Ganmen. Kamina in particular had been the greatest instigator, being the first human to successfully steal a mech from their enemies, and the one to gather other human tribes under a common banner to continue the fight. Episode 8 opens right before their next great step in the war, attempting to steal one of the Beastmen's walking battleships. We begin with Simone, lying almost comatose from fear and indecision, a character theme that will be the underpinning of this episode. The first half of the episode is a series of pre-battle conversations, both pep talks to buck themselves up for the fight, and romantic revelation. True to the spirit of the shows it is emulating, these aren't the deepest conversations, but each is efficient at conveying only the most essential information needed to get the core of the characters and their emotional state. The second half of the episode is the actual assault, and features the show's hallmark maximalist approach to action, as giant robots wail on one another, volcanoes explode in tune with the characters' emotions, and eventually even the explosions start to explode. It is during the assault that Simone's emotional uncertainty rears its head again, throwing the whole operation in danger until Kamina gives him a brotherly punch to the face to center him. After delivering his inspirational speech, Kamina is then ganked by the arrival of the big baddie for this arc, getting ambushed from below, ganged up on, and eventually laser blasted unto death. With the leader of the rebellion down, the plan and the entire revolution seems to be headed for ruin, a worry made literal as Simone, in his shell shock, sends the stolen battleship careening towards certain death inside a volcano. Luckily, Kamina claws himself back to life, snaps Simone out of his funk, and together they turn the tables on the big bad, destroying his mooks in spectacular fashion, and ending him by unleashing for the first time their ultimate finishing move, the Giga Drill Breaker. Unfortunately, once the battle is over, Kamina is too, and the episode ends with the leader and driving force of the series dead, everyone else in mourning or a state of confusion. The previous episode had plastered their episode titles near the beginning, each a hot-blooded piece of dialogue from Kamina, but this episode saves the title card for the last frame, and ends with his subdued final words, "Later, buddy." I think this episode deserves inclusion into the canon for a number of reasons. First, it contains some striking art and moments. The creators eschewed realism and strict visual consistency, opting instead for a more expressionistic approach, where each object and composition was allowed to stretch and deform to fit the desired mood and tone. Thus, the mecha are allowed to have wagging tongues and crying eyes to convey their pilot's emotion. The volcanoes explode and sync with the tempo of the battle, and in one of the most devastating examples, the death blow to Kamina is rendered in a chiaroscuro painting, with all the main characters' reaction captured in fleeting still images. The fights themselves are also some of the best of the series, both in the one-on-one robot duels and in the unveiling of the finishing move. The episode is also perfectly structured and executed. Like much else in the series, there is an underlying spiral structure to the episode, with a small initial starting point being repeated and expanded, so that the start of the episode lays out the themes and motifs that matter, and then later events refine and then hammer them home, or in one case, rocket punch them home. Simone's insecurity and reliance on Kamina have been a running concern throughout the series, and in this episode we see the full spiral arc in miniature, as Simone starts off freaking out before the fight starts, is talked into action by Kamina and Yoko, relapses into insecurity in the middle of the battle, gets punched into sense, relapses again after Kamina gets struck down, gets rocket punched into sense, and overcomes his anxiety for good, until Kamina dies for good. While that structure threatens to be repetitive, the show manages to up the stakes with each iteration out so that the overall effect is one of pleasant escalation, rather than oppressive repetition. The episode is also important for the position it plays in the series overall. Kamina had been the clear fan favorite from the start of the series, and everything in the show positioned him as an important lead character. His death serves as an integral fulcrum point in the show. They even changed the opening title sequence in the very next episode to reflect the loss, and the rest of the series will deal with the other characters stepping up in his absence to live up to the ideals he embodied. Ultimately, I believe that this is a canon-worthy episode for the way that it functions as a distillation of everything good about the cartoons and shows of our youth. Similar appeals to this well of nostalgia usually fall into a trap of attempting to gritty them up to make them more adult, or wallow in the cheesiness we recognize with the benefit of maturity. TTGL recognized that at the core of these shows there are important lessons and themes, and a basic joy that can speak to any age, and presented them not as cheesy, but as worthwhile and fun. To paraphrase, episodes like this are important not because they tell us that giant robots piloted by homicidal gorillas exist, but because they tell us that we can overcome our problems by believing in ourselves and not succumbing to self-doubt. For those reasons, I think this deserves a place in the canon. Thank you for the consideration and love to the show.
Who wants to go first with TDGL?
I'll go first. Okay, we started while this started and I went out loud to our room. You crazy for this one, submitter. So I admire Matthew for, as he put it, taking a big swing, because why do this if not, you know? But this is not for me. And I will also say, like, there are people definitely who are listening who are like, yes, TTGL. We are not among them. I am not sure that I experienced the show the way Matthew did, because what he's describing as, you know, for example, it feels like pleasant escalation as opposed to oppressive repetition. That was not how it seemed to me. And also when he's like, he's saying that the dialogue is unsubtle, like the shows it's emulating. So I'm not sure if he's saying like, this is a gloss or like a take on anime, but without actually necessarily being like, I don't know what I don't think he's saying this is a parody, but I don't understand what kind of a take it is either that makes it different from other anime shows. And like, to me, if it is a spoof, like the spoof is indistinguishable from the thing. It's like the Snowman, the movie where it's like, you can't, it's already spoofed. You can't go further than there's a killer and he puts people in snowmen and the detective's name is Harry Hole. You know what I mean? Like, this is the anime version of that for me. I can understand how this would be a big deal to people who watch the show, but like, divorced from context, this is incomprehensible, and it was a weird experience watching it. So thank you for exposing me to something I'd never would have watched.
Incomprehensible. There's a kid and he's in a robot.
Okay.
And then sometime the robot launches out and the robot's actually a big giant drill. And sometime that big giant drill gets stuck in the torso of another robot. Uh-huh. And it becomes sort of super robot in that super robot Japanese tradition of Voltron.
Sure.
Et al.
Yes.
And then they battle giant King Kongs for supremacy over a volcanic landscape. What is there not to understand?
You're right.
Stupid person.
Anyway, why don't you go next, Dave?
All right. So when I was a kid, and keep in mind that I was like exactly the right age to be raised by Star Wars. I was 5 years old when the first Star Wars came out. So all my playtime was basically taken up by Star Wars. And when you play with all the other kids in the neighborhood, you know, you break out the action figures, you pull them together, you start playing, you know, you start emulating the adventures you saw on screen. And soon enough, you're just like creating sequels in that sort of Batman tradition where now there's three villains.
Right.
And now the Death Star is a super Death Star. What's that? Oh, I stole the Death Star gun and I put it on top of the Millennium Falcon. And now I'm shooting you guys one by one with a Death Star laser. That's this show. Like, this is a kid in a play box going crazy. And there's all these gone to 11 everything, right? Characters, situations, animation style. Like he said, at one point, the explosions have explosions. Like, I'm pretty sure that is actually factually correct. Like, one of the, like, they're all like robots of some kind, but they're all like weird, sort of like, I'm not quite sure how, if you haven't seen it, like, imagine the kind of quality random toy you might find in a Chinese supermarket gumball machine.
Yeah.
That's the kind of, like, there is one robot that looks like a metal banana man, and he fights.
It looks like At Walker's mated with tiki mugs to me.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It's not a bad thing. Yeah. In fact, that was like my favorite thing about the show.
No.
But yeah, it's it's a look.
The one anime show that I was exposed to when I was a kid, and anime didn't really, like, anime's after my time, basically. Like, the rise of it in North America is like well after, you know, I stopped, you know, I was probably in my 20s or 30s. But that was Star Blazers, which is Battleship something or other, is its original title, Yamato, I think. And I love that show. So I'm not like anti-anime on its, you know, on the face of it. I do have some problems with the style when I can't tell how old characters are supposed to be.
Yeah.
Especially when they're like juggy, underboobed, 11 to 39 year olds running around. Like what? Like the infantilization style really is problematic.
Yeah.
Like, I know, like, I'm sure the more familiar you are with anime, maybe there's other cues, obviously height and hair bigness, maybe. I don't know, but like,
like, you know, typical secondary sex characteristics that you get past puberty, big hair
bigness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Certainly. But that is true.
This show is just nonsensical. I could not make heads or tails out of it. I didn't really find any of the characters really compelling. And like the action scenes were so bombastic, you know, and so over the top with, you know, missiles that shoot missiles and robots that have robots. And that, like, it was just, again, it was all star wipes, right? It was just like too much all at once. You know, it suffered from that problem of not really knowing the geography of the fight.
Yeah.
Like that was one thing that Star Blazers did really well. It being, I think, a reaction to Star Wars and sci-fi of the late 70s and early 80s, that I remember that you could tell what was going on when the battleship was fighting the Comet Empire and all the ships were flying around. Not so much in this one. This is just like a celebration of excess. And I think if you are into anime, maybe that celebration is more poignant, you know, like it actually has meaning to you. Mm-hmm. It didn't really to me. I just found it sort of like, you know, the guy in Clockwork Orange with his eyes propped open watching all this shit. Like, what the hell's going on?
Yeah.
And feeling really tired at the end of it. Sarah.
Yeah, same. The geography of the fight comment is dead on. Like, we have no context for this, but I was still willing to give it a chance. But then, like, the climactic battle is like, I don't know where anyone is. The animation doesn't seem to have as much depth. Like, it's something that Samurai Jack used to do, was like do different split screens to give you different POVs on the fight so that at least you could see like cool stuff that was happening. This was all like right, it was like 2 inches from your face, all of it. Like, Nolan Batman fights. Is it Nolan?
Yeah.
Bale Batman, yeah. Whatever.
Or Bourne Identity stuff.
Yeah. That it's like just shot so tight and jittery that you can't tell what's going on by design because they're not very good at this. Like, I know it's a completely different skill set for anime, but I will say this presentation I think would be extremely convincing to someone who knows anything about this genre, but I don't. And one of the things about canons where I personally have no context is like, you know, would I watch more of this? No, unfortunately. Like, I liked the tiki walkers. I liked the fabulous comms chief. I would watch a whole show about him because he reminded me of, who was the blonde judge? What was the name of the blonde judge on the last cycle of Top Model? Drew.
Oh, I don't know.
Something. He looked and sounded like that guy who I loved. yeah, like I just, this isn't for us. And unfortunately, like I can't, with that, we did need context here that we don't have. So.
Yeah. Yep.
Very convincing presentation to people who know what the hell they're talking about, but that's not us.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, I mean, I think this definitely is a canon submission to a different kind of podcast where they specialize in this sort of thing, but we don't.
Yeah, sorry.
This is your vertical market.
Yeah.
Pitch that we're over here. It's over there. I think.
I really admire the moxie though.
Yeah. Points same. For moxie. All right, let's put this to a vote, Sarah D. Bundy.
This is a no thanks, but thank you for the attempt.
Tara Ariana.
no for me too, but please don't let that dissuade you from submitting again in the future.
And I'm going to say no too. And one thing I forgot to mention is that Simon's robot doesn't work because he's sad because the girl in the show doesn't really like him that way because he's four.
Yeah. He's 4 or 29. We don't know.
So I'm sorry to say that Gurren Lagann, season 1, episode 8, Later Buddy, also known as Farewell Comrades, you are not inducted into the Extra Hot Great Game.
Oh boy. Here we go.
Running us off. This is not a canon presentation per se, no. But we did promise that we would talk about our extra hot great Game Time TV show discovery, Nightman. And so I guess we'll just talk it out. Nobody's is going to make a pitch per se.
Oh no.
But we can talk about how this is the best show ever to come across our eyeballs and then put it to a yes vote after. So Nightman, to sum it up very shortly, is a story about a saxophonist, a muscle-bound 90s Fabio-looking saxophonist.
Slash martial arts instructor.
Yes, thank you.
Fuck's sake.
Who was hit by...
Wait, you're skipping over the most important thing about him, Dave. His name is Johnny Domino.
That's right. Johnny Domino was hit by San Francisco daytime lightning while playing saxophone or something in a streetcar going up that Fremont Hill or something.
Yep.
And he gains one power. And this power is the ability to sense evil at play. And somebody want to kind of take a shot at what the particular episode plot is here?
Okay, I'll go.
Okay.
The secretary...
This is the pilot, by the way.
What's that?
I'm just saying this is the pilot.
First half of the pilot.
Right.
I trust
so,
no one watched part two because I...
Oh my God.
No.
When we got to the end and it said to be continued, I was like, I don't think we need to. I am not. No, I said, I'm not watching part two. And Dave was like, I don't think we need to. And he's right.
And then I just looked at the floor sad, like, yeah, I guess we don't need to watch it. I'm totally going to watch part two later. I'm going to watch part two later and I'm going to come back on the full show and give you a report.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Yeah.
Okay. For the first thing I need to say before I even get into the plot is there's no cold open. It just starts you with a theme song and we'll embed it in the show notes because you have to see it. But I said, like, from the first saxophone note, I screamed. Dave can attest. I screamed out loud. What is happening? It comes in so hot for a show like in its very first episode ever. It's like, fuck you all, this is Nightman, like terrible saxophone music. It's so aggressive
and
in its world
even
view.
In the credits, the special effects are neither special nor effective.
No. Well,
so before you even get into the effects, okay, the first shot of the credits is just like this super tight shot of his eyes darting back and forth. Mm-hmm. And then there's the cityscape at night of San Francisco.
Yep.
And the very 1990s font they use for Nightman pops up. And if you are a graphic designer, it's one of those Emerge fonts. You know what I'm talking about. The font, the official font, I hope I'm pronouncing it right. The official font house of the 90s, the guys that basically provided Ray Gun magazine with all their fonts.
that
pops up, but it is like triple beveled and embossed, and there's like chrome on one of them, and it's purple. Like there's so many Photoshop Kai Power Tools effects going on just in the title treatment alone, guys. It is a delight.
Okay, no kidding. This is from 1997. Literally less than 3 seconds into the credits, you would go, oh, this is a syndicated show for sure.
Oh,
like
yeah,
you
totally.
Immediately can tell.
And I just want to say there's 7 people listening to the podcast right now that are high-fiving themselves when they heard me reference Kai Power Tools.
I'm one of them.
I thought you meant there are 7 people listening to the podcast right now because everyone else turned it off after you burped ho, ho, ho.
Okay.
Okay, the plot.
No, wait, we're not done with the credits yet.
Oh, I'm sorry.
So very, very 90s, but also in some respects, like some 80s stuff, like a lot of the secondary and tertiary characters in the credits have this treatment where there is a slowly rotating rectangle of the action. And then outside of that are like primary colored squares. It's very sort of early 90s, late 80s, Saved by the Bell sort of stuff. Like it's a kind of graphic design you would see on movie trading cards of the time. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. My notes were like, are we sure this was shot at any time in the 90s? Because it just seemed like it had been sitting in a can next to silk stockings on some lot since the late 80s. Yeah. No good.
Someone talks on a flip phone at some point. That's it. That's the only marker of like when in time this occurred.
And just one note, I don't know if we'll get to it in the actual plot, but during the credits, we discover that one of the characters, who we of course haven't met yet because this is the pilot, is named Lieutenant Dan.
Yeah, with two N's.
And this is after Forrest Gump, correct?
Yeah. No, he's in it. He's in it. He's the dad's cop friend who's like, I stuck up for you when you blah, blah, blah. He's that guy.
Oh, I know he's in it. I'm just saying we haven't met him yet.
Oh, not when we're watching the credits. Right.
That's right.
Right, right, right. Sorry.
But this is post Forrest Gump, right?
Yes, for sure.
But the comic book might be pre-formed.
It might. Yeah. I didn't do that research, I will admit. Also, just as a side note, like the treatment of this title like really varies from wherever you look. Sometimes it's Night Man, two words. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's Night Man with an intercapped M. Sometimes it's Nightman. One word with no intercapping. Anyway, okay, the plot. God, there's some rogue agents who have a nefarious plan that doesn't become clear until the end of the episode, but they're trying to do some kind of shady weapons deal, and it involves going around the Secretary of Defense, who's played by Budget Jason Robards. What's his real name, Sarah?
James Karen or Karen, known to New York locals around my age as the Pathmark guy. And he was also the floor manager in Wall Street. You would absolutely know him. He's
you have Jason 100% Robards. Seen this guy before. Yeah. Also, one of the bad guys is Healy from Orange is the New Black, the counselor from the prison.
There's also another bad guy, very briefly, played by Sapienza from The Sopranos.
Thank you.
You'll know the voice. You barely see his face, but he'll be like, come on, out of the car. And you'll be like, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So they've intercepted this whistleblower guy and they dangle him off the Golden Gate Bridge because they're in San Francisco. And what else would you do to make him give up his info? And he ends up dead because they drop him. Like, anyway, the incredibly convoluted plan involves the Secretary of Defense is coming to San Francisco for the opening of a thing. Some communications conference or something.
It's
which
like
is
the Comdex of San Francisco. Okay. But it's called like something. It sounds like it's a
Millennium
hotel.
21.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or 21 Millennium, either way. So the VIPs are being ferried to whatever, some kind of opening event in this special, we're told, cable car where they'll be entertained by saxophone sensation Johnny Domino, which is why he's on this cable car. And I love that the show doesn't even bother. Like, they go to the trouble of being like, it's a special cable car. They got live entertainment for it. And yet when we see it, like, no one is paying him the slightest bit of attention, which is what would happen in real life. But at the same time, it's like, this is the best you could do to put him in this confined space is to be tootling away with no one caring a tiny bit that he's doing it. Or present, like, just set up a boombox in the corner. But anyway, that's why he's in the cable car when it gets struck by lightning, and he instantly gets his powers and determines that there's a bomb in a bag that's been left under a seat. And he first of all tries to yell at everyone to get off the cable car, which they do. But then when they're still in the process of getting off it, he just tosses it in the air and explodes and ruins it. Like, it completely destroys a beautiful old San Francisco Victorian house,
he gets everybody off of it, then throws it out.
Yeah.
Like,
and also, why is anyone listening to this? That he's like, there's a bomb on the cable car. Like, the fuck do you know about it, Vesty? Go back to your blowing.
Yes, go back to the sewers, Beauty and the Beast. Anyway, so the fact that this is a two-part pilot seems especially indulgent, considering that his powers come on instantly. Like he's, there's no delay. There's no, like they gradually come into focus. It just, he immediately knows that there's a bomb in his right. And later when he's at the hospital next to the Secretary of Defense, he can hear his thoughts. And that's it. Okay. Then eventually we see the meeting where the shady guys are trying to sell their weapon systems and eventually get around to like the engineer that was involved with the guy who died. And like, we see their whole thing that they developed, which is, please, Dave, describe this fucking suit, because it made me furious.
Oh, like in the video that we see? That,
yes.
Or Nightman suit?
Both of them.
Okay, so first of all, we're treated to a video at a sales pitch, you know, basically sort of like, you remember the scene in RoboCop when they're all in the conference room getting the ED 209 pitch?
Yes.
It's sort of like that, except instead of ED 209, it's just a videotape.
Yep.
And the videotape...
it's a guy in a wetsuit.
No, it's a guy in a camo sort of Tupperware clad... like a Kevlar vest kind of thing, but it's like super shiny. And he's basically got blue blocker glasses on. That's how they make it look high tech, I guess. And it's bullet resistant and he's got like a jetpack built in.
No, and it's not even a jetpack. They say there's this belt that allows you to defy gravity. They don't explain how.
That's right. Sorry. And he just basically floats in the air a bit, shoots a rocket launcher at something on the ground. And everybody's like, yay. And everybody, including one of the three storms from Big Trouble Little China, who Tara tells me was also in the Alias pilot.
Yes.
He was there. And also Babu from Seinfeld was there.
Yes.
In the conference room. Very bad man.
And speaking of Alias, they just keep calling it the weapon system. Like the foundation, foundation or the process or the envelope. Like, guys, just put, name it something with an X in it. Also, I'd like to note that at this point in my notes, there is the phrase, and I quote, Orkin porno? Question mark. Because the suit looks like he's in a porno about pest control.
Oh my God. Really, yes.
Did someone order a bug spray?
He totally does.
That would have been so much more interesting and better made than this. The production values, like, I made up stories with my color forms that were more believable than, like, when they're doing their anti-gravity thing. They're just literally standing there.
Yes.
With the wind flapping, okay,
we'll
even though they're
there.
Not moving.
Wait, we're getting off topic.
We're getting ahead of ourselves. My complaint about this.
No, wait, you're getting off topic. Excuse me. I believe I have an infestation of cockroaches.
We really need to eradicate them.
Yeah.
So in the video, as Dave mentioned, it's a camo suit. Like, what is the value of having a jungle camo suit in the fucking sky?
Air?
Like, why did no one think about this? It's so
and I
stupid.
Conjectured that you only sell that weapons, the weapon system in groups of 80. So it's like zebras. They only work to confuse people. You can't pinpoint just one of the zebra warriors.
Yeah. Although they do, there is a moment in that sales pitch scene where someone is like, do we get a discount if we buy more than three? And she's like, no, this isn't whatever. I don't even remember what stupid joke.
It's a home shopping network or whatever.
Thank you. I knew
accent
you would know.
That was supposed to be like, that woman is from Shaker Heights, period.
So before we get to the second costume, which is Nightman's costume eventually, there is this moment where the engineer that eventually pairs up with Nightman, and stop me if I get ahead of myself, but basically he says, okay, so all of us buddies, the engineering team in this weapons program, made all these weapons, and there was some sort of tomfoolery done with the serial numbers, and it looked like somebody inside the system was basically making the existence of these weapon systems disappear from the records, right?
Yeah.
And something, they're going to shut down the program. And then their solution was to come up with civil uses for all these weapon systems. Like, well, we're trying to figure out how to take these weapon systems and make them work for the police
right.
and the fire department.
Right.
That was their solution to keep, this is their goal, to keep their jobs.
Yeah.
You already have the tech.
Yeah.
You have the know-how. Mm-hmm. All you have to do is make one of these suits and you're set for life, you dummy. Yeah.
Or put on your stealth cape and go to the bank. It's pretty simple.
Right. Yeah.
Dumb shit.
Yeah, they have a cloak of invisibility pre Harry Potter too. So add that to the lawsuits against J.K. Rowling because she also stole that from Nightman.
I will say though, the invisibility effect was like it was 90% of the way to the Predator effect. Like it was pretty close,
mm-hmm.
and that was like the most convincing effect of this.
Oh God,
whole
low bar.
Yeah,
lowest. Like lying on the ground, totally. Low. But yes.
One of the things we don't see in this episode is Nightman flying around as Nightman. We do see it in the credits.
Mm-hmm.
But if you imagine, you know, when they took Christopher Reeve, right, and they put him on that green screen coffee table and, you know, he put his arms out and they shot him like that, right?
Yeah.
And then when they composited it, it was him flying, you know, he was horizontal flying across the screen. So they did the same thing with Nightman. Except, you know, they put him on the coffee table and green screen. They shot him. But when he's flying around, he flies around. They just like tilted that whole scene 45 yeah. degrees.
Yeah.
The physics make no sense. His cape follows the line of his body. Like his cape should be flying straight out.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't. So nope. It just looks like, I don't know. It just looks like he's been propelled by like a superhero fart across the across the screen. It's totally ridiculous. It makes no sense.
It's so fucking dumb. But even worse, in this episode, as Dave said, all we see is him wearing the anti-gravity belt with the engineer guy like clinging to him. And they are just like shooting up to the roof of the,
he's like
to the top of this warehouse.
With the engineer guy, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's like, really weird.
Ever hear of a piggyback? Come on, guys.
Yeah.
Something. So but it's just to go up into the rafters because these crooked Department of Justice agents who are not FBI agents for whatever reason are like swarming.
Did we mention Mr. Healy is one of them?
Yes, Mr. Healy. Okay. I said that already.
Okay.
They end up on the roof. Then they're like up in the sky. And as Sarah said, like they're just shooting them from like clavicle up, basically. Like, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. But like, we don't see the ground as it looks to them. Like, we don't see a longer shot of them in the sky because they don't have the money to make any of that look like even a little bit convincing.
But when we are treated to like a full flying body shot.
Yeah.
The world of physics is totally ignored. It is not to say that they do fantastic stuff that wouldn't work. It's just that they literally are like when Poochie flies home to his whole planet,
he's
the Simpsons, they just
out
lift
it.
The,
yeah.
It is. Yes.
It's that.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's just them going straight up or straight sideways.
Yeah.
There is no nuance to it whatsoever. It is fantastic.
I don't even think they put a fan on and like.
No, it's just like some production assistant blowing on them. Like, hey, like guys, tic tac.
Right. But they don't even bother to make it look like they are not even like standing on their tippy toes in whatever green screen cube they're shooting this in. Like they're just standing there.
Yeah.
They're standing in the sky.
Yep.
Oh, God.
And that's how it ends.
Yeah, pretty much.
Basically, they go up to the sky and they're like, yay, we did it. And Nightman, well, I guess Johnny Domino at this point. He's loving it. He's having a good time, but then the battery runs out and they fall into the water. And that's the break. That's it. To be continued. Oh no, they fell in the water. To be continued.
Yeah. Also, Taylor Dane is in this as his ex-girlfriend.
And she sings.
And Daniel Day-Kim is in it.
Yes, he is.
I didn't realize that Taylor Dane looks so much like a cleaned up Courtney Love.
Me neither.
Until this episode.
She really did.
To me, she looked more Linda Hamilton-y in this, but that might have been the haircut. Yeah, she was okay. She was not the worst thing about this episode, because how could she be?
No.
Okay, so there's two things we've left out. I mean, two things that are missing from this great discovery that is Nightman, which is, well, how does it end? How does this pilot end?
You're going to have to tell me.
I'm going to find out. Number two is, this is not the Manimal episode. This Manimal is not in this episode. That is to come. And you bet your sweet bitty, I'm going to watch that episode too.
Good luck to you.
All your littlest hobo recap fans are really annoyed that you're veering off course to do this instead of that.
No, I have a question.
We're ending the Littlest Reaper.
Are we considering this as a canon entry and
yes.
if it's worse than Jazz?
Yes.
Okay.
It could be everything. All right. So that was Nightman. It is really telling of the TV syndicated universe in the 90s. I just looked it up. It is actually contemporary with Forrest Gump. Both 94, the comic and the film, which means the book probably came out before the comic. So technically, I don't think the comic really, Lieutenant Dan really has an excuse to be named Lieutenant Dan. One N or two.
Yes, yeah. Right.
All right. Anything else to say about Nightman, the best TV discovery of 2017?
Before we put this to I have one more note. TV characters, please stop calling physicians Doc. To prove that you're give it to me straight, Doc. Like, how about just Dr. Chen or whoever it is? Second of all, stop freaking out about being sent to a shrink. It's not a big fucking deal.
Yeah.
Fuck off. Now I'm done.
All right.
Those are both excellent critiques.
I may have missed it when we were looking up the Forrest Gump stuff, but did we mention that Jin from Lost was in it?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Yes, this was amazing. It was so bad. It is, but okay, it is bad, but it is bad in the best way. Like, this is the kind of bad you always hope. This is the kind of bad I wanted the Star Wars Holiday Special to be, but it wasn't.
I mean, I'll give you that. Yes, it is. But
yeah, I see what you're saying.
But this isn't the bad episodes canon.
No, it's not. All right, so let's put this to a vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
No.
Tara, Night Warrior Ariana.
I mean, I enjoyed watching it with you, particularly since every time I looked at you to be like, what the fuck? You were like, you missed something and made me. And then you backed it up because I missed some horrible thing that happened.
Dave. Cruel.
Are you paying attention to this or not? Dave was very, very insistent that I catch every single vicissitude of Nightman season
cop.
One, episode one. Yikes. He was.
I haven't heard a no.
I'm not. No, of course not. Oh. Silly. This is terrible.
Well, guys, I'm going to throw Nightman a bone. I enjoyed this so much. I know it doesn't matter. So I'm going to actually say yes.
Fair
so
enough.
It can be on the record.
Porno
on the
man
record
will throw you a bone.
Nightman. It's great. All right. Unfortunately, that means Nightman, season one, episode one, pilot, probably. I didn't look up what it was called.
I didn't either.
Let's call it Nightman. Unfortunately, even though you were the best thing ever happened to television, you're hereby rejected for the extra hot great canon. Oh. Well, guys, that brings us to the end of our, what are we calling this?
Our all orphan canon episode.
If I may. Oh, Cannonbaum. Oh, Cannonbaum. Nice. Thank you.
We inducted Supernatural's changing channels into the canon, but we rejected TDGL Later Buddy and, for some reason, the Nightman pilot from being in the canon. Are we back next week with Black Mirror, correct?
Yes, we are back with a regular episode next week with our good friend Nick Reinwald Jones.
We'll run down every episode of Black Mirror Season 4 and give you the highlights and the lowlights. We've already watched them all, and another good season, you know, always highs and lows, but, you know, it was enjoyable.
Yep.
We'll have that for you next week. Until then, remember,
we're listening.
I am David Tickle, and on behalf of Tara Ariano.
Later, buddy.
And Sarah D. Bunting.
That's cold. No, he's cold.
That is it for this episode of Extra Hot Crate. We'll see you next week for Black Mirror.
Oh, hateful.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.